VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. Officials issued stark warnings as Hurricane Milton closed in on Florida's Gulf Coast on Wednesday. Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener reports.
Panic buying at gas stations gripped Florida as Hurricane Milton closed in on the Tampa Bay area on Wednesday.
I've been here for 38 years and never have one that forced us to do this.
Meanwhile, officials continued to sound the alarm.
Looking like the storm of the century.
At a White House briefing, President Joe Biden urged Florida residents to follow local safety recommendations. FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell said the impact of the latest storm could be devastating.
Hurricane Milton is going to be a deadly and catastrophic storm. It will bring massive storm surge, high winds, and severe flooding as it moves across the state of Florida.
The National Hurricane Center said Milton was expected to maintain hurricane strength as it crossed the Florida peninsula, posing storm surge danger on the state's Atlantic coast as well.
Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener. U.S. President Joe Biden and Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu talked on the phone Wednesday for the first time in 7 weeks. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
It came amid the president's growing frustration with the prime minister, who's repeatedly ignored U.S. calls for ceasefires in Gaza and Lebanon. The White House says the call lasted about a half hour, with Vice President Harris joining.
It was direct. It was productive.
Spokeswoman Karine Jean-Pierre says they did discuss Israel's response to Iran's recent ballistic missile attack, and while she would not speculate, Israel's defense chief says the retaliation will be lethal and surprising. Sagar Magani, Washington.
This is VOA News. The United Nations says a 250,000 people have fled Israeli attacks in Lebanon over the past 2 weeks for the relative safety of Syria. VOA's Heather Murdoch has more from Istanbul with Jan Boshat in Hasaka, Syria.
In recent days, hundreds of people have arrived outside this camp in northeastern Syria, hoping to find shelter and humanitarian aid. The camp, called Washukuni, is 5 years old, housing families displaced by fighting in 2019 in Syria. But the newcomers are also war refugees, many for more than a decade. They fled Syria's civil war for Lebanon and have now returned, displaced by Israeli strikes on their adopted country. Aisha Ahmed, a Syrian refugee who fled Lebanon a few days ago, says she left everything behind and has found no help in Syria. They have slept outside the gate of the camp for 2 days, she says, without even the use of a bathroom. In northeastern Syria, more than 600 kilometers from the Lebanese border, officials say they have no provisions to assist thousands of returning refugees who are streaming in by car, by bus, or on foot. Heather Murdoch in Istanbul with Jan Boysha in Hasaka, Syria. VOA News.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky will meet NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte and British Prime Minister Keir Starmer in London on Thursday, a boost for Ukraine after a summit of its main backers was canceled at a difficult moment in its fight against Russia. Zelensky and Starmer have both described the war with Russia as being at a critical point, and the Ukrainian leader is keen for the West to deliver long-range missiles and other support to try to change the balance on the battlefield. Zelensky was in Croatia on Wednesday and will meet Pope Francis on Friday. The Nobel Prize in Chemistry has been awarded to U.S. biochemist David Baker and British researchers Demis Hassabis and John Jumper for their work with proteins, the building blocks of life. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Baker designed a new protein in 2003, then one imaginative protein creation after another. He shares his enthusiasm with the AP about a future for this fast-moving field.
I think there's huge there's fantastic prospects for making better medicines, medicines that are smarter, that only work in the right time and place in the body, much more potent vaccines.
In turn, Hassabis and Jumper created an artificial intelligence model that's been able to predict the structure of virtually all of the 200 million proteins that researchers have identified. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
We'll be right back. Abra Caprica from the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Vote counting is underway in Mozambique following Wednesday's presidential and parliamentary elections.
As a young Mozambican man, I feel that this is important because it might be the choice that will change things in our country.
Former Guinean President Alpha Conde is accused of recruiting mercenaries to overthrow the military junta. Sudanese armed forces show VOA weapons that they say were supplied to the paramilitary RSF by the United Arab Emirates. A Turkish contractor signs an agreement to expand the ancient Somali port of Hobyo. Ugandan President Museveni marks his country's 62nd independence anniversary with a call for more Africa economic cooperation.
It is therefore feasible to use the similarities and linkages among the 1.5 billion Africans on the continent to achieve powerful economic and, in some cases, even political integration.
And Republicans and Democrats work to preempt claims of voter fraud ahead of the November elections. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Vote counting is underway in Mozambique following Wednesday's presidential and parliamentary elections. Will the people choose the ruling Frelimo party, which has been in power for nearly 50 years, or something new? VOA Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariam Diallo reports from Maputo. Whoever wins will inherit major challenges, including an insurgency in the oil and gas-rich Cabo Delgado province.
Voters braved morning rain in Maputo to line up as early as 7 a.m. to cast their ballots. They have four candidates to choose from: Daniel Chapo, the ruling Frelimo party leader, Osufo Momad, the candidate of one main opposition party that came in second in the last presidential election, Lutero Simango, the leader of the Mozambique Democratic Movement, and Venancio Mondlane, an independent who seems popular among the youth. At a polling place at the Josina Michelle Secondary School in Maputo, 22-year-old Augusto Page says he waited about an hour, but he had to make sure to vote.
As a young Mozambican man, I feel that this is important because it might be the choice that will change things in our country. So I'm talking about healthcare, education, and development in general.
After casting his ballot, Sergio Panti, a member of parliament and Frelimo supporter, told us he's confident his party will win. He says people continue to love and highly consider Frelimo as an option to continue running this country. The results will prove once again that Frelimo is loved and esteemed by the Mozambican people. Two of the candidates, Momad and Simango, voted at the same polling place where outgoing President Filipe Nyusi cast his ballot. Former St. Lucia Prime Minister Dr. Kenny Anthony, who arrived in Maputo on October 2nd, heads the Commonwealth International Observers delegation. He told VOA his group was still visiting other polling stations and getting reports from other parts of the country. Meanwhile,
there seemed to be some optimism that this is going to be a better administered election than previous elections. Whether that will be the case, I don't know. We have just visited this particular polling station, and all seem to have gone very well here.
Whoever wins these elections will inherit many challenges, starting with the economy and debt repayments. Orr says
it's between $12 and $14 billion in external debt. Recently, they have been able to transfer or pay back much of that debt, but they have done so by way of accumulating a lot of domestic debt.
In addition to debt challenges, the government has been battling an insurgency in the gas and oil-rich Cabo Delgado province, where about 4,000 people have been killed and about 1 million displaced since 2017, hindering multi-billion dollar oil and gas projects. Some countries, including Rwanda, have stepped in recently to help quell the insurgency, an act that Adriano Nuvunga, a social activist and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Mozambique, disagrees with.
Mozambique, big as it is, massive as it is, 33 million people, but it needs to import soldiers from Rwanda to protect its sovereignty.
Ruling party candidate Chapo said if he wins, securing the Cabo Delgado area will be his top priority because without security, there is no development, he recently told supporters. Nuvunga says while Frelimo was seen as a liberation movement 50 years ago, times have changed.
The people here, they have nothing to do with what you people have done 5 decades ago. It's about today. Are you able to put in place credible policies and put in place a credible system of governance that will work for the people?
More than 17 million people are registered to vote. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Maputo, Mozambique.
Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni says his government is doing everything in its power to alleviate poverty, but that his administration alone cannot employ all the country's large number of unemployed youths. Addressing the nation Wednesday evening to mark Uganda's 62nd independence anniversary, Museveni said his government is creating an enabling environment for citizens to be job creators. Reporter Mugumi Davis Rakarinji has more from Kampala.
Speaking at the celebrations of the country's 62nd independence anniversary, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni said his government is assisting citizens to be self-reliant, to be job creators. Museveni said his government can only employ about 500,000 people in the public sector. The president said his administration has created opportunities using, in two quotes, palace government model, a village initiative where citizens are accorded affordable credit, which enables them to become self-employed.
We have diversified, going away from the colonial deception of having what they called cash crops and non-cash crops. We told our people that anything that is used by society on a large scale can be a cash product. Hence, maize, milk, cassava, beef, bananas, fruits, forest products, etc. are now cash products. These products deal with the import substitution and expanding our exports.
He said the population is steadily getting out of poverty with about 67% of people in what he calls a cash economy. Museveni said African countries, including Uganda, should work together to discourage the export of raw materials to Western countries. Kamara Kankwasa is a lecturer of political studies at Kampala International University. He says one thing the government must do is to attract foreign investors.
Foreign investment establishes opportunities, establishes industries, establishes organizations. So the foreign direct investment can surely create jobs. Then Uganda also has to enhance regional markets. Uganda produces abundant food, which is a nexus of the necessary food, which surpasses the market.
Museveni says that is why it is important for African countries to trade among themselves.
It is therefore feasible to use the similarities and linkages among the 1.5 billion Africans on the continent to achieve powerful economic and in some cases even political integration to ensure our prosperity and guarantee our strategic security.
Museveni also announced government plans to build a railway network connecting the country with Kenya in the east and South Sudan in the north. The government is also constructing the road network that connects with the rest of Africa. With the country still dependent on foreign aid and suffering from high unemployment, unreliable infrastructure and poor services, analysts say Uganda has not achieved the aspirations envisaged at the time of independence. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
In Guinea-Conakry, the military junta says plans are underway for an attack by mercenaries from neighboring Liberia. The junta has accused former President Alpha Conde of recruiting mercenaries in Liberia for an assault. Prime Minister Amadou Ouare Ba says that some of the mercenaries have been arrested and extradited to Guinea. Reporter Karim Kamara has more from Conakry.
Guinea's military junta has placed its army on high alert along the border with neighboring Liberia following the arrest there of alleged mercenaries accused of planning to attack Guinea. The president of the Guinean National Transition Council, Dansa Koroma, says there is a substantial risk of insecurity along the border with Liberia.
D'après les informations, la Guinée courait des risques sérieux d'insécurité le long de sa frontière avec le Liberia.
He says, according to intelligence gathered from Liberia, Guinea is at high risk of insecurity along the border with Liberia. He says the information was revealed to them through a friendly intermediary in Liberia. The announcement of the planned attack on Guinea was first reported by the Liberian press recently after police there arrested a Guinean national, Ibrahim Khalil Sharif. He is accused of having received $150,000 for former President Alpha Conde to recruit mercenaries in Liberia to overthrow the military junta in Guinea. Liberian authorities have not yet officially commented on the issue. Speaking during a press conference here in Conakry, General Amara Kamara, a spokesman of junta leader Mamadi Doumbouya, accused former President Alpha Conde of being behind the alleged plot to overthrow the military junta. He says efforts are underway for the former president's extradition so he can face justice. He says the first had the news from the Liberian press that a Guinean national had been arrested, and after an investigation, it was revealed that the man was working with former President Alpha Conde to carry out a coup d'etat in Guinea with the help of other people. He says Guinea can go after anyone wanted by Guinea judiciary anywhere in the world to answer charges. He says former President Alpha Conde is no exception. A senior member of the former ruling party RPG of former President Alpha Conde, Sekou Conde, describes the accusation as baseless. He says the junta is running ahead of time. He says this is a witch hunt and persecution against members of their party. He says now they want to target the president of the republic who did not resign his post as president of Guinea. General Mamadi Doumbouya promised to return the country to civilian rule on December 31st, but according to the opposition, there is no indication that the junta leader is ready to relinquish power by then. The opposition has vowed to make Guinea ungovernable if junta leader Mamadi Doumbouya fails to abide by his promise to step down. Edouard Zoutoumou is a member of the opposition.
Mr. Doumbouya is just trying to find a way to announce his own candidacy, but he hasn't found a way yet. December 31st, 2024 is the day the transition will end. Anything after that, we are not going to accept it.
Since his overthrow, former President Alpha Conde has been living in exile in Turkey. Recently, the French press reported that the former president was somewhere in West Africa. The news has continued to concern the military junta. Like the former president, all of Guinea's main opposition leaders have fled the country for fear of being arrested by the military junta. As December draws nearer and without a response by junta leader Mamadi Doumbouya, some Guineans are apprehensive about the future of the country. For VOA Africa, I am Karim Kamara in Conakry.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Boughty in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 10th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The Sudanese Armed Forces has shown VOA weapons that they say were supplied to the paramilitary RSF by the United Arab Emirates, which will be in violation of UN arms embargo. Henry Wilkins reports.
The Sudanese Armed Forces say this crate once contained bombs used against them by the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, the opposing side of Sudan's civil war. It's stamped with the address of the logistics arm of the United Arab Emirates military. Sudan is under a UN arms embargo, but analysts and rights groups say these imported weapons are making the conflict worse. Cameron Hudson is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a Washington-based think tank.
If the UAE were to suspend all support to the RSF and were to tell its partners in the region not to support the RSF, I think that this war could be over very soon, quite frankly.
The SAF also showed VOA rocket tubes and burnt-out vehicles they said could only have been supplied by Abu Dhabi. The UAE's foreign ministry tells VOA it is not providing any support or supplies to the rapid support forces or to any of the warring parties in Sudan. But a UN report says there is credible evidence to the contrary. Hudson says the UAE is attempting to gain geopolitical influence in Sudan and the surrounding region.
That the UAE has had this competition with the Saudis in the Horn of Africa for many years. It seems to be doubling down on its investment, not just in Sudan, but in Chad, in Ethiopia, in Kenya. So I think the UAE wants to be the kind of great power in the Horn of Africa.
Iran has also violated the same arms embargo by providing drones to the SAF, according to the Dutch non-profit PAX. The Sudanese ruling council has denied this, according to media reports. VOA asked Sudanese finance minister Jibril Ibrahim if the SAF had been receiving support from Iran.
This is the official institution of the country. They can buy arms from anywhere.
The Iranian foreign ministry did not respond to a request for comment. While nations vie for influence in Sudan, civilians are bearing the brunt of the conflict. UN figures show 11 million people displaced and 25 million needing humanitarian assistance. Mariam Mohamed Farah Naim was injured by RSF shelling in early September.
I knew right away that my legs were broken because when they told me to move before the second bombardment, I couldn't. My daughter was hurt as well. She was screaming, screaming, and screaming.
A year and a half in, the world's largest displacement crisis shows no signs of letting up. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Omdurman, Sudan.
Turkish contractor Netak Holding on Tuesday signed an agreement to expand the ancient Somali port of Hobyo, according to local media. Netak's deal will see the company run the port for 80 years. The federal government of Somalia says the aim is to turn this small settlement of 11,000 people into a regional trade hub. Abdi Ismail Samatar is a professor at the University of Minnesota and a senator in the Somali parliament. He tells VOA's Douglas Mpuga that the project has great potential but also creates a lot of legal and existential problems.
Without national centralized plan for the water, the sort of a properties of the country, then anybody can do this. So it has a great potential. It also creates a lot of legal and sort of existential problems for different people in different parts of the country.
But this port is strategically located and it would even help maybe ease tensions with Ethiopia. Do you think so?
No, I don't think so. Ethiopia is interested in having a naval base. That's the fundamental thing because it already has a commercial access to the ports of Djibouti, three ports in that country. And so what this is doing, it is the national sort of an ecosystem of the country in Somalia is being pilfered by individual groups, which will sort of continue to sort of, if you like, undermine the collective national agenda to coordinate its ports and the development of its infrastructure. Virtually anybody can do any of these things now, given what has happened in Hobyo. So the national government should have the authority to be able to map out what the country needs, and then the regions can develop that. But if every Tom and Harry does that, then it means that anybody can get into the waters of Somalia without national reconnaissance and understanding.
Yeah, but the government in Mogadishu says the aim is to turn the small settlement of about 11,000 people into a regional trade hub for Ethiopia, an alternative trade to Djibouti, and to decongest the port of Mogadishu. Is that a fair assessment?
No, it's a wrong assessment, and it's a pedantic assessment. If you want to develop infrastructure that has what economists call economies of scale, then what you can do is plan this such that you have the Bosaso port, you have the Berbera port, you have the Djibouti, but you have the Kismayo port, you have the Mogadishu port. All of these ports, if they are developed substantially, can serve the country. And then if you want to develop communities along the coast, there are other ways to do this rather than duplicate and undermine. So the infrastructure scale of Hobyo, of other places, the country doesn't have the resource to develop those things. So on the one hand, it undermines Mogadishu and it undermines Bosaso, it undermines Kismayo. But on the other hand, it creates a false hope for local communities when those local communities should really be focusing on how to exploit and use the resources, in particularly in the form of fish, properly.
Abdi Ismail Samata is a professor at the University of Minnesota and a senator in the Somali Parliament. He spoke from Minneapolis, Minnesota, with viewers Douglas Umpuga. Former U.S. President Donald Trump and many of his supporters claim, without evidence, that the 2020 election was stolen, and warned that the same could happen in 2024. Democratic and Republican election officials in Michigan dispute their claims and are working to assure Americans that their votes are secure. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wadikuswara brings us the story from the state of Michigan.
This was the scene in Detroit, Michigan on Election Day 2020. Supporters of Donald Trump, fueled by his baseless claims of election fraud, pressured officials to stop counting votes. Many Trump supporters in Michigan are worrying about fraud in the upcoming election.
Right now, our government, you got to question everything about it. I mean, I wish I could say differently, but that's not how America feels. We don't. We don't trust nobody.
One case is enough to question the whole system.
Allegations that the 2020 election was rigged have been repeatedly debunked in U.S. courts. But disinformation around election integrity has gained traction among Republicans. Polls show they are more likely to trust Trump over government-certified election results. Officials in battleground states are working to assure voters that the election process is secure. They say disinformation can be dangerous. Jonathan Brader, director of the Michigan Bureau of Elections.
They can, in some cases, lead to people making threats to election officials or worse. But even if it doesn't result in any sort of physical violence, it does undermine trust long-term in the election system, which is bad for our republic and is bad for our democracy.
In many states, Republicans support efforts to assure voters that elections are secure, including Justin Roebuck, a Republican election official in Ottawa County, Michigan. He says it's an uphill battle.
Our political leaders at every level need to also seek facts and to seek data. And I think until that happens, we will have a problem, you know, in terms of our confidence and trust in the process.
In Michigan, Trump loyalists have already sued Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, a Democrat, over absentee ballot processing guidelines and the voter registration list. Michigan Republican Party Chairperson Pete Hoekstra.
If Jocelyn Benson is not responding to what is required under the law, we will take her to court to get the courts to compel her to do that.
Benson dismissed it as a Republican campaign strategy.
In general, we see lawsuits masquerading as a legal strategy when they're really a PR strategy to get misinformation or sow seeds of doubt about our elections into the narrative.
Republicans and Democrats have launched election-related lawsuits in various battleground states, which could mean chaos in the November election.
Kim Wyman, senior fellow with Bipartisan Policy Center's Elections Project via Zoom.
Any kind of legal challenge happening this close to an election typically is lawyers putting a placeholder in case they may not win in a state or may not have an outcome they like, and it gives them the ability to challenge the election after the fact.
There are other potential disruptions, including efforts by county officials who support Trump to delay election certification. Patsy Wadikuswara, VOA News, Flint, Michigan.
And that's it for this Thursday, October 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for being our guest this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barty in Washington, saying have a great day, or please be safe, whatever you do.
Africa presents the latest news about Africa and the world and its news summaries. Africa in Brief airs every day at 400, 500 and 600 UTC. Give us 5 minutes of your time to be brought up to date. Africa in Brief, your trusted source.